You're listening to Split Reel, the Chicago Independent Radio Project show on popular culture and societal attitudes. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and I'll be examining how film, television, and other elements of mass media both shape and reflect how we think about the world. For more information or for archived shows, visit splitreelradio.net. Welcome to another edition of Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm happy to be joined today by Russell Peterson, who is an adjunct assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Iowa, and he's also the author of the recent book Strange Bedfellows, How Late-Night Comedy Turns Democracy into a Joke. Good morning, Russell.
Good morning.
So we're going to be talking all about the impact of late-night comedy on how we view the political process in America, everything from The Tonight Show to the Leno and Letterman shows to Saturday Night Live and also The Daily Show as well, too. And Russell, what prompted you to embark upon the research path that led you to the Strange Bedfellows book?
Well, it's in a way a culmination of a lot of things I've always been interested in, a lot of kind of threads coming together. I've always loved comedy and grew up at a time when there was sort of an explosion of what you might call meaningful comedy, things like George Carlin and Monty Python, Mel Brooks and Woody Allen at their peak as movie makers, Saturday Night Live, SCTV, and Doonesbury, and Watergate, as I discuss in the book, was kind of a moment where politically themed humor became more mainstream. And I was in my early teens then. I was 13 the year Nixon resigned. So I really grew up being very interested in comedy and thinking of that stuff as sort of belonging to me the way people maybe a generation older than me thought of early rock and roll as sort of being their music. I thought of this as sort of my comedy, I guess. So I sort of turned all those pursuits into scholarly interests, and that's sort of why all of that interest turned into a book.
You mentioned briefly the Watergate scandal. Why specifically was that such a watershed moment with regards to late-night comedy?
Well, I think it made topical comedy more mainstream and more acceptable. Television critic, I think it might have been John Leonard, said at the time that when Johnny Carson started making jokes about Watergate, then that kind of made it okay for everybody to make jokes about Watergate and for that to kind of be the topic of mainstream fun making. And there was a little cottage industry of people making funny audio records about Watergate and commenting on it every place from the funny pages to television. And before that, remember, we'd had many years of sort of political upheaval, which, well, there was certainly satire going on around that. It was hard to be involved in that without very militantly sort of taking a side in the larger struggle that was going on. But Watergate was kind of absurdity that I think almost everybody felt they could get in on.
Nonpartisan comedy,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at things that have been very productive of a large volume of topical jokes, they're usually things that are more absurd, like the Lewinsky scandal or Watergate. And not that they're equivalent, but they both had sort of elements that lent themselves to making jokes about them that didn't really have that much at stake politically. So Watergate was kind of the first of those to happen in the television era. Everybody could make jokes about Watergate on television in the early 70s, but in the late 60s, the Smothers Brothers trying to do topical comedy produced a huge controversy and got the show canceled and turned them into a cause celeb and all of that sort of thing. So it was a very short space of time, and Watergate happened to be the perfect thing at the perfect moment to sort of make topical comedy more mainstream.
One of the things that you do in your book early on is you make a clear distinction between genuine satire and quasi-political satire. I think you just, you know, define those two categories for the audience. What are we talking about with regards to genuine and quasi-satire?
Pseudo-satire is actually
pseudo-satire.
The sort of 5-cent definition of the distinction, I guess, is that genuine satire means it and pseudo-satire doesn't. And to expand on that a little bit, genuine satire often takes a side in a political debate, but regardless of whether it takes a side or not, it takes the debate itself seriously. It takes politics seriously, even though it's making a joke and trying to get a laugh, whereas pseudo-satire tends to be dismissive of politics overall. And that's what we see a lot more of. And that, getting back to the idea of Watergate, you could certainly make genuinely satirical jokes about Watergate, and a lot of people did. But you could also easily do sort of pseudo-satirical jokes about Watergate that just treated the whole thing as only an absurdity and not also as a serious crisis, that used it as evidence not that a particular administration had committed particular crimes, but that politics is just a circus full of crazy people and this is always the way it is. And pseudo-satire is much more pervasive because it's, for one thing, much safer. It's nonpartisan, almost by design, it's nonpartisan. It's really anti-political rather than political in any meaningful sense. And this is what we get from Jay Leno and from David Letterman and from Johnny Carson before them, a kind of, aren't they all a bunch of clowns? And I'll try to tell approximately the same number of jokes about Republicans as I tell about Democrats, so I seem unbiased, but I'm going to treat them all with sort of contempt and not take any of them seriously. And that way, there's really no stakes in that kind of humor. It appears, so I call it pseudo-satire because it appears to be engaging in politics, but really, it's not engaging in politics, it's dismissive of politics.
One of the things that you do early on, getting back to the subject of pseudo-satire, Chevy Chase's Gerald Ford character in Saturday Night Live,
yeah,
in the very early days of Saturday Night Live. And so here are skits that really serve to make no political points whatsoever. It's just Chevy Chase falling down all over the set and bumbling and stumbling and continually reinforcing this image of Gerald Ford being incredibly inept. It's interesting that this is one of the elements, one of the characters that kind of put Saturday Night Live on the map. Are you surprised by this, given how, you might say, primitive the comedy is, you know, if you go back and watch skits from 30 years ago?
Well, Saturday Night Live is an interesting case in considering this distinction that I try to make in the book, and maybe an illustration of how the distinction, and any time you try to set up categories to discuss or analyze any cultural phenomenon, you have to be careful that the categories aren't too rigid. Saturday Night Live has occasionally, in its long, long 35 years now history, occasionally engaged in genuine satire, but it's mostly been pseudo-satirical in spite of its reputation for being edgy. And one of the hallmarks of pseudo-satire is that the jokes tend to be ad hominem. They tend to be about personalities rather than about policies. And that's certainly the case with Chevy Chase's impression of Gerald Ford. It's entirely ad hominem. It's not about anything that Ford stood for, believed in, policies that he tried to enact, political philosophy that he supported. It's about him being an oaf and falling down and speaking with a lot of malaprops and being stupid. It's entirely personal. At the same time, if you look at the history of Saturday Night Live, although it's definitely not genuinely satirical, at least you could say this of Chevy Chase's Ford impression, it did have one hallmark of genuine satire in that they sort of stood behind it. It was harsh. And a lot of what they've done subsequently as far as topical comedy has been kind of cuddly almost. And the fact that Chevy Chase made no attempt to sound like or look like Ford is an important component of that. You know, there's the old saying about imitation being the sincerest form of flattery. There was no flattery in this at all. Whereas years later, Dana Carvey doing an impression of George H.W. Bush, even though that gave them the opportunity to make sort of more substantive critiques of Bush on occasion to really be genuinely political, it also kind of made Bush into a lovable character, which the Ford impression didn't really do. He was funny, but you didn't have affection for the real Ford because of it, because there's nothing like the real Ford. Whereas Carvey's impression of H.W. Bush became one that H.W. Bush himself grew quite fond of and sort of co-opted and invited Carvey to the White House and became friends with Carvey even. And that couldn't really happen with Chase and Ford.
One comment about Ford, and then I want to talk a little bit about Carvey's Bush. You know, in the book, you talked about how the response to Chevy Chase's impression was so strong that you actually got a reaction from the White House. And they were interested in appearing on the show to kind of try and defuse the image, the attack.
They wanted to co-opt that and prove that they were good sports and sort of at the same time neutralize it as a critical force. They wanted to neutralize that critique by showing that we can take it and we're good sports and we think it's funny too. And they tried really hard to do that, and it backfired on them pretty spectacularly, in part because this was when Saturday Night Live was brand new, and the one time in their history probably that they really lived up to their reputation for being anti-establishment. Al Franken, who is now Senator Al Franken, who was a writer for the show at the time, met Ford's press secretary Ron Nessen at some social function and sort of as a joke invited him to appear on the show, and Nessen thought this is a great opportunity to turn the tables on them and show what good sports we are. So he accepted, and the writers and producers of the show decided we're going to teach them a lesson, and turned out what had been to that point the dirtiest show they ever did, kind of to embarrass the White House. It was kind of a nasty thing to do, but again, at least you could say they had the courage of their convictions in that case.
You're listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Russell Peterson, who is an adjunct assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of the recent book Strange Bedfellows, How Late Night Comedy Turns Democracy into a Joke. And we've been spending the last few moments talking about the impact of Saturday Night Live, especially in the early days. On how people view the political process. A few moments ago, you mentioned Dana Carvey's George Bush as kind of, no pun intended, kinder, gentler political caricature than Chevy Chase's Gerald Ford. And I just had a chance to rewatch a skit recently that you mentioned in the book is actually one of the few times that Saturday Night Live has engaged in genuine satire. And it's this great mock of a debate between Bush and Dukakis back during the presidential race in 1988, where Bush essentially has nothing to say in his responses. So he struggles to come up with even 2 minutes worth of time in his answers in this political debate. And meanwhile, John Lovett says Dukakis has this great line at the end where he mentions that he can't understand why he's losing to Bush.
I can't believe I'm losing to Bush.
Shortly after that, he became president, and it's interesting because in this little clip that I saw, he's president, and this is just prior to the first Iraq invasion back in 91, Desert Storm War, where Carvey, as Bush, is cracking jokes about Hussein. He's cracking jokes about the slew of Sidewinder missiles that U.S. is going to rain down upon Iraq. And it's interesting. It's rather jarring in the sense that you wouldn't see, obviously, such bravado, such carefree attitudes today. You couldn't even make those kinds of jokes today. You know, one thing that you do talk about in the book is that how it's so tough to do comedy that's centered around war. And this is one of the few times that I guess it was acceptable. Why do you think that was the case?
Well, I think it has to do with something very basic about jokes. Every time a comedian tells a joke to an audience, he's sort of asking for a referendum on the joke and on the premise of the joke. And if people buy the premise and sort of agree with the premise, they will laugh at it. And if they don't, they'll not laugh at it and they'll reject it. So it, I think, has less to do with the acceptability of war in general than it does with the acceptability of that war specifically at that time. And going back to that time, and I'm old enough to have been an adult at the time of the first Gulf War, so I sort of remember this, although there was a very intense debate before the war started, it was sort of a triumph of public relations by the time the war actually got underway that the media was a big part of. It was pretty safe to sort of cheerlead for that war early on. And I found that appalling at the time, but by doing those jokes and the fact that those jokes succeeded, that was sort of the results of the referendum at that time, that you could do those jokes and people would go along with them because they'd sort of been sold on the idea of that war. Whereas now, we don't have that right now about the wars that are going on. We did have it right after 9/11. I mean, think of some of the jokes about going to war right after 9/11, going into Afghanistan, and even going into Iraq early on, some of the jokes about killing Saddam Hussein that Letterman and Leno told, and without stirring much controversy. It really is a matter of reading public opinion and pushing things as far as public opinion will let you in a given moment. That moment has passed again, but it will probably change again too. I mean, you can look back at old Warner Brothers cartoons from World War II, which are fairly shocking in their what we would today see as jingoism and sort of enthusiasm for war, but that was reflective of that war and those times. So those jokes were okay then. They were acceptable then.
Near the end of that Carvey skit, Carvey as George Bush, they have a little mention, a little appearance of about a 10-year-old kid playing the role of Dan Quayle. And that was a common theme in Saturday Night Live, that they'd have this little boy playing Quayle whenever he showed up in the Oval Office. And in your book, you mentioned about how Quayle is, I guess, one of the first public figures to be completely destroyed by late-night comedy. Is there any recent politician, you know, since that time, in the last 20 years, that you think perhaps has been rendered completely powerless by late-night comedy?
That's a good question. I want to make a comment about Quayle before I answer that, though. The reason that Quayle was so profoundly a victim, I guess you could say, of late-night comedy had a lot to do with Quayle himself and his sort of very public and very easy for anyone to see mistakes, the sort of way he looked, the way he spoke, the things he said lent themselves to kind of easy, pseudo-satirical, personality-based jokes. But it was also a matter of timing. Quayle came along right at the moment when late-night television was undergoing this big change. After being a very sort of stable entity for a long time, Johnny Carson was on his way out. David Letterman was establishing himself in the Jay Leno-Letterman battle was sort of on the horizon right around the time of Quayle. I mean, the Leno and Letterman thing came to a head a little bit after Quayle, but so Letterman particularly sort of really rode Quayle in his monologues a lot. So that was part of it. As far as other politicians, and I don't necessarily think Quayle was treated unfairly or badly, but I do think he was somewhat the victim of circumstance, and certainly most of the jokes told about him were unfair in as much as they were more about personality stuff than about more substantive critiques of his politics. I mean, not that character doesn't count for anything in a politician, but it was all personal and not at all political. As far as other politicians, more recent ones, I do think that generally speaking, female politicians still get treated a little bit more unfairly. I don't necessarily agree with Sarah Palin that she got treated particularly unfairly, but I think in general, female politicians get treated a little bit unfairly. I think actually, the prime example of that was Janet Reno.
She's played by a man, I think, right?
Yeah. And that was the whole joke, was that Janet Reno, whether it was Will Ferrell playing Janet Reno on Saturday Night Live, or whether it was Letterman or Leno or anybody else making a Janet Reno joke, the only joke that was ever told about Janet Reno was that she was too masculine, that she was a failure as a woman, right? Not that she was a bad attorney general, which there were plenty of jokes to be made about what she did as attorney general, which would have been totally fair game. But nobody did jokes about that. They did jokes about what she looked like and what her voice was like. And, you know, a lot of the jokes about Hillary Clinton were like that, too, and a lot of the jokes about Sarah Palin as well. So I think the fact that, you know, late night television, where most political humor comes from as far as the popular stuff that reaches a broad public, the fact that that's still sort of one of the last all-male preserves, all-white male preserves on television, with a few exceptions around the fringes, a few low-rated exceptions, maybe has something to do with that.
You're listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Russell Peterson, who's an adjunct assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of the recent book Strange Bedfellows: How Late Night Comedy Turns Democracy into a Joke. One of the notes in your book that I was surprised to read is that folks like Nixon and Kennedy had appeared on Jack Parr's Tonight Show, Jack Parr, the host before Johnny Carson. And it kind of had seemed to me that the age of presidential candidates appearing on late night talk shows is a relatively recent phenomenon. Now, first of all, your take on Jack Parr's politics, how that went over at the time, also in comparison to his successor, Johnny Carson.
I guess the primary difference is that Jack Parr was less coy about his politics than Carson was, and maybe a little less careful. And that's partly a difference between the two men, but it's also partly the sort of growing up of the television medium into what they decided it ought to be by the time Carson took over The Tonight Show in 1962, where the idea of broadcasting, that, you know, we're going to attract the most eyeballs by being the least offensive we can be to the most people, kind of really became the paradigm. And before that was sort of set in stone, there was more room for a guy like Jack Parr, who was a little less calculated in appealing to people and a little freer to indulge his personal quirks and tastes, and to be more political. Parr did a show from the Berlin Wall once. He early on praised Fidel Castro, which he later retracted. He had both Bobby and John Kennedy on his show, as well as Nixon. He later claimed to have been a Republican all his life. And John Carson wouldn't really do any of those things, especially the last one. Johnny Carson was always very careful to not admit to having any particular political beliefs, and was very guarded and cautious about appearing to have any political beliefs. He wanted to seem like he was a completely neutral observer and made fun of everyone equally, which sort of became the idea of being an equal opportunity offender, which we still hear comedians claiming to be.
Jumping forward to the 1990s, one of the hallmark events in terms of his intersection of late night comedy and politics was Bill Clinton's appearance on Arsenio Hall's show when he was running for president in 1992. Famously plays saxophone with Arsenio Hall's band. Was Arsenio Hall reluctant to poke fun at Clinton after he appeared on the show? Is that kind of a danger that you see with politicians who appear on late-night talk shows, that, you know, becoming friends with the host, therefore they're going to somewhat insulate themselves from criticism?
I think it's somewhat of a danger. I think what's interesting and what's happened since that time, and where it's now become pretty routine and even expected, to the point where Letterman was sort of challenging John McCain to appear on his show and saying, you know, the road to the White House leads through me, only half in jest. I think the thing that is interesting about that is the power that it gives these hosts. And I don't think it's much of a danger to the kind of comedy that those hosts do, because what they do is so politically trivial anyway. I'm talking about Letterman and Leno. Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, that's a different story because they do more genuine satire than pseudo-satire. But it is somewhat of a dangerous territory for politicians to get into, I think, because most of them have learned the lesson of Gerald Ford trying to co-opt Chevy Chase, and they're going to be more cautious about how they approach this. And they've gotten better at generally going on those shows and not making fools of themselves. But still, you know, even if somebody who's on the verge of becoming the next president of the United States goes on David Letterman's show, it's David Letterman's show. And you are playing second fiddle and straight man to David Letterman in that chair, no matter who you are. That can be a tricky place for a politician to negotiate.
Yeah, I mean, not only do you have politicians appearing on Letterman, I'm pretty sure that Obama was on Ellen and Oprah's show in this past election cycle. You know, and I'm also thinking back to the Bill Clinton appearing on MTV's little forum where he was asked if he wears boxers or briefs. Is this kind of thing seen as demeaning to the office, or at least when it occurred?
Well, I think the first time any of those things happen, there's always a little discussion about that. But I was just talking about the dangers of appearing on these shows, but obviously there's a pretty big upside, too, or none of them would do it. And Clinton's appearance on Arsenio proved that, and there might have been a little grumbling at the time about, oh, you know, look at the way the candidate is debasing himself by appearing on the show and participating in this circus and all this, and the sunglasses and the saxophone and the joking around and all that. But the thing is, it worked. Clinton's campaign was sort of in crisis before that. He was getting a lot of negative media attention. His poll numbers were going down. He appeared on Arsenio in a forum where he was not going to be pressed very hard, where the audience and the host were both going to be a little more friendly toward him. And so he had a little more control over the situation, even though it was a kind of odd situation for a politician to be in. And, you know, it was soft media exposure, and he handled it well. And that is the reason that Obama will go on with Oprah or something. He gets to set the agenda a little bit more than he would if he was on, say, 60 Minutes or Meet the Press or something like that. The setting is going to be a little more friendly and maybe for a lot of people a little bit more relatable than a kind of more traditional grilling by the press.
Well, that kind of leads me into my next point. You know, much has been made of the fact over the years that Americans want a president they can sit down and have beer with. Obviously, late-night comedy plays to the attitude. You're seeing these politicians in roles that kind of dispel their aura of importance. But even on the campaigns, you know, it's important for Obama to go bowling out in Pennsylvania, or for Hillary Clinton to go up to a bar and get a shot of whiskey. And are you surprised, though, by the fact that fictional presidents, so folks like Jeb Bartlett from The West Wing, or David Palmer from 24, or Harrison Ford's president from Air Force One, they're often shown as very heroic, very larger-than-life type characters. And you couldn't even imagine these sorts of figures as being the butt of jokes on a Saturday Night Live show or on The Daily Show. I'm always fascinated by that sort of dichotomy in terms of how we would like to view our fictional presidents versus how we want the reality to be. And any thoughts on that issue?
Yeah, it's sort of an illustration of the fact that we have conflicting desires about this, that what the American public wants, and you know, every political consultant and every ad man and every television producer wants to figure out what the public wants. And one reason that they can't do that with any consistent success is that what the public wants is somewhat incoherent and contradictory. And that's certainly true of what we want from our politicians and especially our presidents. We want, on the one hand, the hero president, this sort of godlike figure that the Jeb Bartlett or the Harrison Ford president or whoever it is. But our actual presidents, we want the freedom to mock them, and we always do. we have this sort of contradictory desire, and that speaks to something pretty deep and pretty long-lived in American political attitudes. There's this great essay by Lewis Rubin called The Great American Joke. And this is in, I believe, an introduction to a book of essays covering American politics over many years. And he talks about the central American joke being the disconnect between our ideals and our reality. The ideals set forth in the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and then the actual reality of our real politics and our real leaders. And that, I think, is particularly important for Americans because, you know, as Woodrow Wilson once said, somewhat infamously, I guess, although I think he was right in what he meant, America is the only idealistic country in the world. What he meant by that was that it was the first nation consciously founded on a set of ideals. The proposition, as Lincoln much later said, that all men are created equal. That's an impossible standard to live up to, and yet it is one of our founding principles. And that founding principle especially is difficult to live up to, the idea that we're all equal, with this other philosophical strain that's really strong in America, the idea of individuals each being unique and competing with each other, and the idea of sort of the transcendent individual, the hero like Jeb Bartlett. You know, we've got this idea that the president can be a kind of superhero or a savior, and yet we also have this idea that who's that guy think he is? He's no better than me. He should want to have a beer with me, and he should be a regular guy, and where does he get off using all those big words? So we have both those ideas at the same time. They're in complete contradiction with each other, but they're both based on really fundamental American ideals.
You're listening to Split Real for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Russell Peterson, who is an adjunct assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of the recent book Strange Bedfellows, How Late Night Comedy Turns Democracy into a Joke. Something that we haven't discussed today in this interview is The Daily Show. And The Daily Show, you discussed at great length in the book, talking about how it's one of the few examples of genuine political satire, and also The Colbert Report as well, too. With The Daily Show, you quoted Jon Stewart as saying that the reason that they went after Republican targets so often is that the Republicans were the regime that were in power for much of the past decade. Have you seen any shift in the nature of the attacks since 2008, since Obama's election and the Democratic takeover of Congress?
It's interesting that you single out that remark by Stewart, because as much as I want to give Jon Stewart and The Daily Show credit for doing a much smarter kind and much more often genuinely satirical kind of comedy than the traditional pseudo-satire that the network guys like Leno do, he's still sort of trying to use the same deniability strategy that those guys use. Like, we make fun of whoever's in power, and we don't really have a horse in this race, and we make fun of everyone, we're equal opportunity offenders. He still tries to do that. And I think that's sort of a weakness of The Daily Show in a way. And if there's a hero of my book, it's Colbert, because he's the one person that I see with a broad enough audience to count that is really doing something different and has really got a forum and a format that allows him to be a really politically engaged critic and not sort of to any extent, even to the smaller extent that Jon Stewart is compared to someone like Leno, a sort of pseudo-satirist who's always trying to balance things and look like a neutral referee. And Jon Stewart still has to do that, partly because, unlike Colbert, he's appearing as himself. And he has to ingratiate himself as himself to the audience. And even though his audience is, I'd say it's a pretty safe thing to say, largely liberal and democratic rather than conservative and Republican, he still wants to look somewhat neutral and somewhat disinterested. And that's not all to the bad. I certainly don't think it's good for satirists to turn a blind eye to people that they're sympathetic to. But it also is a kind of easy out. You're making fun of the people that you formerly seem to support. You know, what do you really stand for? Is this all just entertainment? And Colbert, because he's playing a character, can have a sort of more consistent engagement in politics, I think, than Stewart can really have. I think sometimes on The Daily Show, the criticism of liberals and Democrats is sincere. And other times, I think they do it just because they haven't done it for a while and they want to look balanced. And I think that's kind of a weakness that I see on that show sometimes.
Do you see necessarily then that satire has to be partisan in order to be genuine?
I don't think it absolutely has to be partisan. But to get back to Stewart just for a moment, I think that the way the interviews are, because the interviews are unscripted, I think he's more honest in the interviews in a way than he is in the comedy. And that, you know, you would expect that. But I don't think there he's being calculated in the interviews to the extent that he sometimes, not always, is calculated in the comedy and pays at least some attention to this sort of notion of being an equal opportunity offender. And that's what I somewhat object to with him. I think he's actually more consistently good and interesting and in the interviews than in the comedy, although I think his batting average in the comedy is fantastically high. I mean, I'm a big fan of Jon Stewart. I don't want to give the impression that I'm not. But to get back to your question about partisanship, I don't think it's absolutely necessary that to be useful or to be good that a satirist has to be partisan. But I think if there's not some kind of philosophical consistency, then it becomes pretty hard to say that I believe in anything. And I think that the truly great and thoroughly genuine satire tends to be often partisan because it arises out of real conviction and not just sort of opportunistic joke making.
Can you think of a satirist that you admire who is conservative in nature?
I think you can go back to someone who is arguably conservative like Mencken, but this book got reviewed in the National Review, which is, of course, a conservative magazine, and their biggest criticism of the book, as I remember the review anyway, was that I didn't celebrate any conservative satirists, and I guess that's true, but I don't think that right now that the present construction of what we now, right now, call conservatism lends itself to being a good base from which a satirist can operate because it's driven by ideology. And I don't think it really deserves a name conservatism, actually. But what I'm getting at with this is that the term conservative and the term liberal are words that have been so abused that they're meanings have sort of been somewhat lost to us. There's an argument that all satire is basically conservative in one sense of the word, in that it wants to return to some imagined ideal place that has been betrayed or abandoned. But that starting point that we're supposed to return to, that ideal state that we're supposed to return to, might be let's return to the idea of free speech and let's return to the idea of freedom of religion, which are ideas that we consider liberal. So the terms get very confusing.
The definition of the term conservative, you go back to Goldwater even, you know, I mean, separation of church and state, and he was more of a libertarian.
Right,
at least
right.
That's how it would be defined today. You know, so, yeah, these terms are very fluid.
Yeah, which is one reason that I don't have sort of a contemporary example of a conservative satirist. But I think there have been and there will be again when the ground shifts a little bit more. But in terms of people who have tried it recently, I mean, I think Dennis Miller kind of famously refashioned himself as a voice of the right a few years ago. And I'm pretty hard on Dennis Miller in the book to the extent that I discuss him, because I think that he has allowed ideology to trump any other consideration in what he does. And I think it's sort of killed him as a comedian, frankly. I don't think that what he does works comedically anymore. And I don't think that that is the inevitable result of having the politics that he has. I think that the nature of his politics, where ideology must trump everything else, has kind of made him into an unfunny person. And that can happen with liberals, too. I mean, it happened pretty famously for a while with Mort Saul, who has sort of been all over the map politically in his long career. But at some point, he got the reputation for lecturing his audiences instead of entertaining them. It happened to a degree to Lenny Bruce, and it can certainly happen. I guess you could say it happened in a sort of different way to Al Franken, where he went from being purely an entertainer to being a politically engaged satirist to being finally a politician and leaving comedy behind.
How do you feel about Michael Moore?
I think Michael Moore is sort of, I guess if you wanted a bookend or a mirror image of Dennis Miller, I think Michael Moore would serve pretty well. I mean, I think he's also somebody who has let ideology trump everything else in what he does, including his sense of humor, but also, pretty crucially for both of them, his powers of observation. I think that whereas a lot of people once sort of looked forward to a Michael Moore movie with great anticipation, I think now the announcement of a new Michael Moore movie fills a lot of people, including people who would in the past have been pretty sympathetic with his politics, fills them with dread because they think he's going to do a sort of hatchet job and it's going to be ideologically driven and it's going to be unfair and it's going to be unfunny. So, yeah, I think it's sort of a professional hazard. And there's a great book by a guy named Will Kaufman, which I cite in my book. And Will Kaufman coined this term irony fatigue to describe what happens to a lot of satirists. And Mark Twain is sort of his prime example. Mark Twain, a guy who became famous as a humorist. And the longer Mark Twain lived and the more he wrote, the more pessimistic he got and the harder it was for him to be funny, because he cared too much about what he was writing about. And at some point he said something like, I'm paraphrasing, I don't want to kid the things that I'm against. I want to destroy them. It got very hard for him to be funny towards the end. And, you know, that tends to happen to a lot of satirists. You know, I listed a whole bunch of them that it had happened to. And I think it happened to both Dennis Miller and Michael Moore in pretty short order.
You're listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Russell Peterson, who's an adjunct assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of the recent book, Strange Bedfellows, How Late-Night Comedy Turns Democracy into a Joke. And we just have a few moments left, Russell. I want to talk about a subject that I've been involved in studying a great deal as of late, and it's the subject of comparative political cultures. The question is whether you have looked at all at political comedy in other cultures. For instance, Great Britain. A lot of people have commented on how British campaigns have come to more closely resemble their American counterparts in recent years. Is there a late-night talk show culture or tradition like there is in the States? How do people view, say, the parliament and the prime minister, whether it's Great Britain or also other democratic regimes?
I can't honestly say that I've done a thorough survey of comparative political comedy regimes, if you want to use that word, around
sure.
the world. But in my dissertation, from which the book is sort of loosely adapted, I had a chapter which was sort of left on the cutting room floor when I turned it into a book, discussing the Soviet literary theorist M.M. Bakhtin, who was a victim of Stalin's gulag and did his scholarship and writing sort of under that shadow and under the threat of persecution, and wrote a lot about medieval culture as sort of a way to criticize the regime under which he was living in disguise. And Bakhtin's big idea, or one of his big ideas, was to celebrate what he called the carnivalesque spirit and carnivalesque humor, which is typified by things like the Feast of Fools. If you've ever seen any version of The Hunchback of Notre Dame where they crown Quasimodo as the King of Fools, this is sort of a set of rituals. Mardi Gras is another example that were usually tied to the church calendar in some way. You know, Mardi Gras is right before Lent, and it's kind of a topsy-turvy time where people make fun of authority by doing things like crowning the King of Fools and having kind of semi-blasphemous rituals right before they get serious about whatever church holiday is the day after the carnival, right? So Bakhtin thought that this kind of humor was really great, that it was really something that reflected the spirit of the people, and he loved how anti-authority it was and how crude it was. There was a lot of sort of bodily function, scatological, sexual humor aimed at authority figures. And I think that there's a notion that this kind of humor, this and this basic anti-authoritarianism is at the heart of humor, and especially political humor. And I think that's a notion that overlooks the idea that different cultures are going to have different kinds of humor that is effective within those cultures. Bakhtin was writing in the Stalinist Soviet Union, and he was writing about a medieval period that was also very authoritarian. So this idea of humor being sort of revolutionary, the idea that George Orwell famously said every joke is a tiny revolution, I think he was wrong. I think Orwell was sort of wrong about that because he overlooked the fact that not all political systems and cultures are the same. I think Freud had it more nearly right when he said that any joke that is anti-authority sort of gets an automatic laugh, whether it earns it or not, because we count any rebellion against authority as a merit, as a good thing. And I think that the failure to appreciate that distinction is pretty pervasive in people thinking about political humor. In the United States, we think anytime you stick it to the man with a joke, you're being brave and doing a great thing. Well, that would be true if you were living in an authoritarian regime. If you were living under Stalin and you told a joke about Stalin, you would be very brave. If you live in the United States and you tell a joke about Barack Obama, you're Jay Leno. You know, you're not brave at all. In fact, the most revolutionary thing I think you can do in America in terms of making a political joke is to make a joke that takes politics seriously or that takes a side, because those are things we're not supposed to do, right? There's a sort of social pressure not to do that. I think in hearing me talk about this, and maybe even in reading the book, some people will be kind of put off by the fact that I don't think it's a good thing to mock all sides equally, and because I see this celebrated all the time. You know, the great thing about this political satire is that it mocks all sides equally, or it's equally hard on liberals and conservatives. I think that's a cop-out. That's very easy to do. What's harder to do is to really do a joke that takes a stand and takes politics seriously. That, I mean, this is a very roundabout way of sort of answering your question, but I think that there's some pretty important differences in the role of political humor and the kinds of political humor that are effective or that take some guts and bravery to engage in depending on the kind of system and society that you live in.
Yeah, I'm thinking of a couple of examples. One you mentioned in your book, which was Bill Maher after 9/11, talking right. about how it was more cowardly for the U.S. to drop bombs from 30,000 feet than it was for someone to give up their life flying a plane into a building. And how I believe it was ABC that canceled his show soon afterwards.
Yeah.
Another example that I'm thinking of is the cartoon strip This Modern World. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yes, yes.
This Modern World, which is published online by a gentleman who goes by the name of Tom Tomorrow. Very partisan, very leftist, but also incredibly biting. And you know, even if you don't necessarily agree with the politics involved, I don't on every occasion, but I think it's an excellent example.
Yeah, and I think the thing to sort of go back to something I said before is being partisan is not a worthy goal or anything like that in itself, but having the courage of your convictions is. And I think even if you don't always agree with Tom tomorrow, and I'm with you, sometimes I very vehemently disagree with him, but at least he says what he believes and he doesn't sort of pander and try to show himself to be balanced just for the sake of showing himself to be balanced. I think that there's a difference between doing that and being what you might call a fair broker. I think being a fair broker and calling out, quote unquote, your own side when you really think that they've done something wrong or you really want to criticize them, I think that's a good thing. But I think just doing it for the sake of appearing neutral or balanced, you know, we get enough of that kind of phony balance in the media already. I think comedy is a place where, you know, if it's worth anything at all, it's a place we go for honesty rather than for sort of calculation and pandering.
You've been listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I've been happy to have been joined today by Russell Peterson, who is an adjunct assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of the recent book Strange Bedfellows: How Late Night Comedy Turns Democracy into a Joke. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate your time, Russell.
Thank you, Kevin.
For Russell Peterson, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. And for more information or to listen to archived shows, visit splitreelradio.net. That's splitreelradio.net.